Let's get this road trip on the road. Man, this guy's not convinced we're going anywhere. So my philosophy is, let's have some beer.
Hey, how old do you have to be to get that discount?
65.
65? Hey, man, now that's discrimination.
Another one of those smart-ass college kids talking themselves into buying 2 6-packs instead of one.
How did you know it was a girl?
You slid her open.
Oh, yeah.
You're sick.
Nice.
Boom, 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 boom.
Another one of those smart-ass college kids.
Boom, 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 boom.
One of my dad's favorite things is battle axe.
Not there now.
No shit. But I just took it with him.
How can you be sure? Maybe it was stolen.
Sometimes he takes his toys home for a while.
Well, I'm a little uncomfortable.
I'd feel a lot better if you'd report it to the police.
Well, what about Mike and Linda? They're still outside, you know.
If you hear anyone wandering around downstairs, don't shoot. It's just me.
Where have you been? Where are the others?
I don't know. I'm scared. Something's wrong.
Girls, just calm down.
No, Mike and Linda have never come back. Ralph went to go look for them, and now he's gone, too. Help me find them.
All right, all right.
We'll find him.
Yeah, we'll look around down here.
Hi, this is Tracy Savage, Debbie from Friday the 13th, Part 3. For the best podcast ever on old slasher movies, be sure you find Hysteria Continues. You will be glad you did. And hey, stay out of Crystal Lake, okay?
And indeed you are. Welcome back to the Hysteria Continues, episode, I think it's 144, and this time we're all going on a fall break. And we're joined by a very, very extra special guest. It's
You're too kind.
Well, Ewan Kant from Arrow Video, which is is amazing to have you with us because Ewan, I'm sure many of you know if you're listening to the podcast and you're a fan of The Mutilator, is that Arrow Video put out an amazing edition of The Mutilator a couple of years ago now, wasn't it? I think, Ewan.
I think it was February last year.
Okay.
But yeah, time has definitely flown.
Yes, but and Ewan, I was just going to talk a lot more about this later. But a feature length documentary on there with lots of interviews with the cast and crew of the film. Which, if you haven't picked up the Arrow release, then it's definitely worth picking up. It's one of the best extras I've seen, and I expect you've seen that, Eric, as well. Have you got the Arrow release?
I do, yes. Of course. I bought it the second it came out.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we're absolutely, you know, it's fantastic.
And you can say what you like about me, but I do have the original copy of this, so there.
Okay, no, we believe you. We believe you, Eric. We'd never doubt you. But it's great.
I think you would.
But it's great to have you with us, Ewan. And also,
thank you very much.
You've been out in the States, haven't you? Doing some extras for another video, Nasty, that we're kind of involved with.
You've done your research, yeah. I just came back from a few weeks in the US. I was in LA, and then most importantly, I had a little crossover to Georgia, down to Tybee Island, where we shot a location featurette for The Slayer. Mm-hmm. Well, we did a bunch of stuff for The Slayer. We recorded the audio commentary with Joe Cardone and Eric Weston, who's executive in charge of production, and actress Carol Coddenbrook, who famously gets the pitchfork through her chest. Mm. Also Joe's wife, as it happens. So we were doing that, and then we went over to Tybee. Same with The Mutilator, I was just obsessed with the location, and I really wanted to go and see it and explore it and, you know, focus on that for the release. And we also did a screening of The Slayer in the Tybee Post Theatre, which is where some of the film is set. Mm. So that was quite amazing as well.
Yeah, that's because it was in the film. It's obviously, it's kind of derelict, isn't it? But it's been completely renovated, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, mm. I mean, I think when I started kind of researching a bit about the film and the locations, that was the first thing I hit upon. I came across this theatre that was located on the island, and I saw some pictures, and I went back to the screen grabs from the film, and as remarkably different as it looks now, it was obviously the same structure. So I got in touch with them, and basically it had been kind of abandoned since like the mid-60s. Mm. And they had renovated it. It'd been like that for 30 odd years, which is obviously the period that they came and filmed it in The Slayer. And it was restored. I think it was only a couple of years ago it actually reopened to the public. So
it looks in the film like it's in the middle of nowhere. Is it in the middle of nowhere, or is it urban?
No. Well, what they were telling me is, I mean, obviously this is 37 years ago, so apparently the island has become a lot more built up since. But I think those shots you see, kind of looking directly at the building, that is how it was. You know, I mean, there's not many buildings around. It's been built up a lot. But then when you have the angle looking back at, for example, Kay, you know, who's looking up at the building, that's actually somewhere else. So wow. It's not as close to the beach. It is very close to the beach, but it's not quite as barren as it looks there.
Movie magic.
There you go. Lots of that going on. So, but yeah, no, that was really exciting for me. And we've done a location featurette. So, so hopefully everyone will enjoy that when it comes out.
Excellent. When is that out? That's out in...
The Slayer God's Willing. It's out August 22nd.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to it. Obviously, there's a commentary from yours truly on there, our little collective. Mm. So, thanks for inviting us to do that. That was a good one to do. We'll talk much more about what you do and also what you did with Arrow on The Mutilator coming up. But also to say hello to Nathan and Joseph. How are you both doing on this fine morning?
I'm a little afraid to talk right now, so I'll let Nathan say how he's doing.
Why are you afraid to talk, Joseph?
Because every time I open my mouth, Skype starts going, eh, 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 eh.
Oh. Yeah. He's doing it again.
Well, we have warned Ewan about the Skype gods of not being too kind to us last time. As you probably, if you suffered through our Hitcher episode, you'll know that everything went a little bit pear-shaped, to say the least. But fingers crossed, it'll be all right. Because we'll persevere. But it might get a bit.
Sorry,
choppy.
Nathan, how are you doing today?
I was actually talking, but I had my phone on mute, so none of you could hear me. That's how I'm doing.
Yeah.
So Ewan can see behind the curtain of the History of Continues, seeing how professional it is.
Well, it is. Yes. In fairness, it is 6 a.m. or something for Joseph and Nathan.
Yeah.
Or is it 7?
Yeah, I was wondering why you settled on that time. I thought it was going to be... I figured it for the stateside people, it was going to be early in the morning.
I think it's just work schedules. It's kind of, I think, for both Nathan and Joseph had to work on Sundays, haven't they?
Okay.
At some point, part in time in the past, but yes, well, we're going to be talking about The Mutilator and saying it being a bit choppy will be obviously kind of quite apt given what we're going to be talking about. Before we do that, we're talking time on tradition about things we've watched, and of course we recorded last week, and so we're banking up shows, so we've got content throughout the summer, so we may be a little bit scant on recently seen. But Ewan, have you watched anything of note that you think might interest people listening? I'm sure.
Well, I think probably of most relevance to the show, I went to the BFI on Friday night for a double bill of Slumber Party Massacre 1 and 2.
Mm, wow.
Oh, I can hear Nathan Fainting in the background.
Oh, my God. I love those movies.
I'm going to be completely upfront and say that's the first time I've seen those films. They just for whatever reason kind of passed me by. Mm. And it was part of the BFI do like a cult strand now, which Michael Blythe programs. He does some liner notes for us as well. And he puts together a really, really fun schedule of stuff that would probably never have been shown at the BFI before, like Slumber Party Massacre 2. And it was really interesting. They had it was presented by the Final Girls. Do you guys know them?
The podcast. Is it a podcast?
I'm not sure if they have a podcast. They describe themselves as a film collective, which kind of considers horror movies from a sort of feminist perspective.
Okay. Yeah, I think I saw them mentioned when it was promoted on Facebook, but yeah.
Yeah, so they kind of had a talk after the first film that, you know, they were talking about Slumber Party Massacre being the kind of the first or maybe only feminist slasher film.
Mm.
So that was really interesting. I mean, the films themselves speak for themselves, really. you know, had a really good time with them. Probably if I was pushed, I would say number 2. Mm. Probably had the best time with the impromptu rock and roll dance sequences. It was just a lot of fun. And, you know, the kind of girl band stuff is really entertaining as well. I love the lip syncing. I'd like to go back to them both. You know, maybe the first one might kind of sneak into top place if I watch them again, but just purely for that viewing experience.
But did you like Sally's Pie in the Sky song?
Yeah.
Was that number two?
Yeah,
it was in number two when she's sitting on the sofa and she's singing it. It's before that big zit on her face explodes in the bathroom.
Oh, yeah, vaguely. It's all kind of melded into one crazy fever dream. But yeah, I do recall something about pies and skies.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of a rarity, but for a film to go so completely in such a different direction and tone and everything as well. Although the first one was quite spoofy, but the second one just takes it to a completely different level. Or the third one is actually quite serious in tone, isn't it?
Yes, very, actually.
Yeah, so it's kind of, yeah, they're all over the place tonally, but, you know, it's a good time. And I imagine it was, did the audience lap it up?
It was great. The first film was actually sold out, which was, you know, really good. Everyone was kind of, you know, laughing along in, like, the appropriate moments. You know, sometimes I've been to see slasher films, you know, kind of quote-unquote retro screenings in other cinemas where the kind of laughing along is perhaps less kind of with the movie and more at the movie. Mm-hmm. This felt a lot more kind of with the movie, which was good. So it was kind of, you know, the right amount of kind of, you know, laughing and just enjoying the movie, I would say.
Excellent. Oh, that sounds great. I mean, it's probably a bit of a one in a lifetime experience, isn't it? I remember seeing.
I didn't even know that was happening. Did you, Justin?
Yeah, I thought we mentioned it to.
Oh, did we?
Nathan.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you guys aren't London based, but keep an eye on BFI Cult on their website. They're showing really, really good stuff every month. I think they've got The Lift is coming up quite soon. Hmm. The Dick Mars film. There's something else, but it escapes me at the moment. But I've seen some really great stuff as part of that strand. And Michael Blythe is actually the person who was responsible for programming Nightmare Maker as part of the Flare Festival, which was pretty incredible to see at the BFI.
Yeah. I saw Friday the 13th Part 3 in 3D at the BFI
many years ago.
But that was an experience. So
yeah,
brilliant, excellent. Well, thank you, Ewan. Is there anything else you've seen?
I saw a couple of weeks ago, I saw 47 Meters Down, the shark movie.
Oh, okay. That's, I think Joseph talked about that. That's not been released yet, has it? But I think in our Hitcher episode, you mentioned you've seen that.
No, Joseph had seen another one with a similar title about girls in a swimming pool, wasn't it?
Oh, that's a different one, is it? Okay. Sorry.
So just for full disclosure, because I wasn't sure if it's out here or not, I didn't baby Jesus it, just to go on record.
I was waiting for Justin to accuse you.
I was waiting for that coming up. I've got my excuse ready and fabricated. It was I saw it while I was over in the US, so that's my excuse.
Okay.
I just found myself with an evening to spare, and I just kind of fancied going to the cinema and, you know, I'm a big shark exploitation fan, so I couldn't really resist it.
Excellent. Is it any good?
I'm not particularly a tough crowd when it comes to shark movies, I must say. So for me, I enjoyed it. I guess my only kind of gripe is that I wish, as much as I really, really loved The Shallows, I wish that they kind of didn't rely so heavily on CGI for the shark. I wish they would just throw in kind of a prosthetic here and there just to mix things up a bit. So I'm definitely not like a fan of all the kind of sci-fi Sharknado stuff. That's kind of, you know, I like my sharksploitation to be ridiculous, but still, you know, kind of on the right side of believability, I guess.
Okay.
If that's possible to say.
Yeah, so there wasn't a kind of a hero seagull in this one then?
No hero seagulls. No. For the most part it was, you know, as it says on the tin, 47 meters down. I mean it was you know, enjoyable. If you know, you kind of know what you're going in for going to that kind of film. So if that's your kind of flick, if you like The Shallows, if you like Cage Dive, I don't know if any of you guys are seeking Cage Dive, which is now being sold as Open Water 3 in the US, I think.
Okay. No.
Oh, that's some serious typing somebody's doing.
Taking notes.
Nathan.
No, I'm muted again.
Okay.
Oh, Joe, it's Joseph. He said he's going to switch to his iPad. He'll be right back.
Okay, okay. We usually hear typing when it's Joseph cheating in quizzes.
But, yeah, I know. Yeah. Are you?
I've never cheated.
Cheaters.
So we've lost Joseph for the moment. We'll persevere.
And of course, this will all be left in the podcast because we don't do any post production work. Well, on the podcast.
I've got to sit down after this podcast and edit the Hitcher episode, which is going to be an absolute nightmare because that was just full of Skype dropouts and interruptions and stuff. But you persevere like true professionals we are. Thank you, Ewan. Eric, mm-hmm. How about you? What have you been watching?
Okay, well, because it's only a week since we recorded, I've been watching basically The Mutilator and our Patreon pick, which we're recording later today. But I also watched a film I got from Arrow a good few months back, but I never got around to watching it. It's Burnt Offerings, which is the Oliver Reed, Karen Black, Bette Davis movie. It's kind of like a precursor, I suppose, to The Shining. It has they all go off to this lush mansion in the country for the summer, and the mansion appears to have a life of its own. It's not quite a haunted house movie. Well, it is, I suppose, but it sort of has a slightly different twist on it, I suppose, is that the house is trying to regenerate itself by it seemingly sapping the life force out of all the people that are living within it. It's very much of a slow burn movie. It's directed by Dan Curtis, who did, he was a TV movie veteran or a TV veteran as well. He did Dark Shadows and Night Stalker, and he produced Trilogy of Terror. So the thing with the film is it's pushing 2 hours, and it's not what you might call an action-packed movie. It's not an effects-based movie at all. It possibly could lose maybe 10-15 minutes, but I did enjoy it. I thought it had a lot of similarities to sort of this modern trend for haunted house movies like The Conjuring, and because I'm kind of old fashioned and I'm turning into a grumpy old man, kind of like Justin, I tend to prefer
you saying turning rather than turned already. But anyway, carry on.
Why? What did I say? Did I say something grammatically incorrect again?
Well, no, you just said you were turning rather than you'd already turned.
Yeah, from hanging out with you too long.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. And I've lost my train of thought. I was just going to say I prefer sort of 70s haunted house movies to the modern variants, which makes you sound like a grumpy old man, but that's the way it is. Yeah, so Burnt Offerings, I'm looking forward to delving into the extras as well because there seems to be lots of stuff on it.
Cool. Excellent. There's a film. Is that what got Karen Black in it? And is it Betty,
yes.
Betty Davis in it as well?
Betty Davis, yeah. Yeah. She plays the aunt. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one I think I've seen. Again, it's one of the ones I think I've seen years ago, but I can't remember.
Mm. I think it's one that it's because it's quite, in terms of its violence, it's quite tame. Mm. I'm sure it probably appears on television schedules quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Excellent. Well, thank you, Eric. Anything else?
No, that's it.
Okay, well, before we try and get Joseph back, I don't know, do we have you, Joseph?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
We can hear
yes.
you.
Yes.
Loud and clear.
Is it loud and clear? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. It sounded good. So, Joseph, do you want to go while we're still on a winning streak?
I have not watched anything this week. I've been way too busy. So.
Okay. Well, that's a missed opportunity anyway, but good to have you back. Nathan, how about you?
Well, aside from The Mutilator and our Patreon pick, I really hadn't had time to watch anything else. The only other thing I've been watching is The Great British Baking Show, which I very much enjoy, but it's not horror. So
The Great British Bake Off, you mean?
Well, over here they call it The Great British Baking Show, but yeah, it's the same thing.
Now, sorry to interject. This is something I wondered because when I was there, I saw that it was called that. So do they still refer to it? This is obviously a question everyone's going to be dying to find out the answer.
Oh, well, I'm dying to find out, yes.
Do they refer to it in the show as the British Bake Off? Do they cut that out?
I think they cut that out because I don't recall hearing it because it took me a while to find.
And as a follow-up question, does Bake Off not make sense in US speak?
It does.
I was wondering.
It would make sense over here, so I don't know why they changed it.
It's not slang for something, is it? It's not a euphemism in America.
No.
I'm going upstairs for a bake-off.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm going to have a quick bake-off. I'll be right back.
That's what I was wondering. It might be.
Yeah. But it's kind of reminds me of the way your book was renamed States.
Just a slasher book, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes,
but there's really no reason for them to have changed it. I don't know why.
It's Paul Hollywood and Mary Berry and Mel and Sue. It's the usual. It's not a remake of it, or
yeah. And the two hosts, I think, are very funny. I don't know. They're kind of campy, so they're very funny to me.
Yes, they're very rude. They like their innuendos. probably friends of Justin's.
Yeah, I love British innuendos, though. I think they're fun. See, over here in the South, in the United States, there are no innuendos. Everybody just says exactly what they're thinking. So there's no, you know, there's no cleverness.
Well, cleverness and innuendo aren't really.
No. But I imagine we'll
see. Like innuendos, they are kind of clever.
Yeah, we'll slip a few in later, shall we?
There you go.
There you go. So, well, thank you. Thank you, Nathan.
Well, Nathan, if you like humor, I've got probably my best joke of the week ever for later in the
week. Oh, sweet. Okay. Yes, I'm ready.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'll just regale you with a little bit of what I've watched. I haven't watched a great deal, say we recorded last week, but I saw a couple of because I get Love Film, which means that we've spoken about it's kind of DVD, Blu-ray rental through the post. So you have a list of films and then they send you whatever is available, which means sometimes the problem with it is that sometimes you just get stuff you don't particularly want to watch at that moment. But they seem to be sending us a lot of Hammer stuff at the moment, and the 70s things I spoke about last time. I think it was Straight Through Till Morning and Goodbye Gemini. But they sent through Fear in the Night, which is another Hammer. It's like a giallo, actually, the Hammer giallo from 1972. It's got Joan Collins and Peter Cushing and Judy Geeson in it as well. So it's kind of, but it sounds more fun than it actually is. It's very slow paced about. And Ralph Bates, actually, Judy Geeson is kind of like a young wife who goes to a kind of abandoned school, or seemingly abandoned, with Ralph Bates as a teacher there. And Joan Collins is kind of the bitchy headmaster's wife, headmaster's played by Peter Cushing. And Judy Geeson keeps on getting attacked by a black-gloved stranger whose arm keeps falling off, who has a fake arm on. And so you're trying to work out whether or not she's mad or there's some kind of something. So it kind of starts off a bit like a giallo, but it's very slow moving. It's not one of my favourites, but it was worth a watch. Anyone seen that one?
Nope. No, I don't think I have.
No. Okay. Well, I wouldn't rush out to see it, but it's not one of Hammer's best. But the other film I saw on Netflix was Here Alone, which is kind of fairly new. I think it's a Netflix original, actually, or it was certainly a film that Netflix had bought up. It's yet again another variation of the zombie theme, but again, a bit like when you talked about Last Girl Standing, where you've got, excuse me, you've got kind of like the indie movie take on the slasher movie. This is kind of the indie movie take on the zombie movie, where you've got, it's a woman, there's basically societal breakdown, and the woman goes into the woods with her husband and baby to try and escape it, and they kind of survive, a bit like the kind of cross between The Good Life and Grizzly Adams, where they're sort of avoiding these kind of zombies, and she's basically left alone for a long time, and she's kind of literally in the middle of nowhere in the forest, and she kind of spends lots of time trying to catch animals and trying to eating berries, and then she stumbles across two other survivors, and it's just the dynamics are there and trying to get food and avoid being eaten by zombies. Again, it's quite good. It's really nicely shot, but it's again a kind of zombie action movies don't, and indie kind of whingy drama don't necessarily mix that well. Again, anyone seen that one?
Nope.
No,
I haven't seen that one.
No. Okay. Well, again, it's worth a watch, but it's not. So I haven't seen anything particularly exciting. Although, of course, we are going to be talking about The Mutilator shortly, and I did read back my Hysteria Lives review of The Mutilator, which is incredibly scathing. I've forgotten how much I hated it, but so we shall see if that's still the case. So without further ado, shall we go straight into The Mutilator?
Let's.
And so here is the trailer for The Mutilator, and after this, Ewan's going to bring us back in with a synopsis.
Mm-hmm. 4 days of R&R at the beach. I'm in.
She's in.
I'm in.
Sounds good to me.
I got a bad feeling about this.
Yeah, we're gonna have a good time.
They thought their vacation would be fun. They were wrong. Dead wrong.
He's what's called a trophy hunter.
Bum, 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 bum.
Dad used to tell me that he'd hunted everything but man.
Hey!
I'm coming
The Mutilator.
Ed, a likable high school student, busily discusses vacation plans with his friends when he receives a message from his father asking that he close up the summer house at the beach. While his friends feel that it's the perfect opportunity for a vacation, Ed is uneasy about the request, as his father has never quite forgiven him for the accidental shooting of his mother. When the group arrives at the summer house, they discover Ed's father's collection of bizarre weapons. To add to their anxieties, there is the ever-present feeling that they're being watched. Suddenly, Ed's house guests begin to meet bizarre deaths, each one more grisly than the next. But the Mutilator is saving the best for last, the best for Ed. That's the synopsis from the Vipco release. It's the DVD release, although I think that's the same as the old VHS, which is how I discovered the Mutilator, so I thought it appropriate to use that one. Pass on to someone else.
Okay, well, we'll come back to you a little bit more about, obviously, you've got a lot to say about what you went and did over in the States, but let's give some thoughts. I mean,
yeah. I can follow that up if you want to cut that bit out and just, I wasn't entirely sure if you wanted me to just rattle off or what.
Yeah, if you want to rattle off, that'd be perfect. Yeah, so that's,
I'll just lead in from that then.
Okay, great.
So that's the synopsis from the Vipco release on the DVD sleeve I'm looking at, but I think it's the same as the VHS. The VHS, for those of you who don't know, Vipco is was a kind of legendary UK film distributor who kind of cut their teeth with distributing many of the films that ended up being persecuted under the Video Nasties debacle of the 80s. So that's how I discovered the Mutilator, on the shelves of Virgin Megastore in Oxford Street, when they used to have the horror section down in the basement. And that was the synopsis I read. It always used to really amuse me that the sleeve for the VHS, I don't know if any of you guys have seen it, the old VHS, it has the image of the Mutilator, and then it has laid onto the figure is the face from the Bogeyman VHS, which is really odd.
Okay.
Anyone seen that?
I don't remember if I have seen that, actually. I remember I've got the...
I have that VHS, but I don't have it here in front of me to...
It's got the outline of the Mutilator, and then they've kind of superimposed in a kind of classic Vipco kind of way the face from the Bogeyman of the priest with the blood down his face. It's very strange. Anyway, so that's how I discovered it. I was probably about 13 or 14 when I used to patrol the horror aisle of Virgin Megastore, and I think I had to... I had limited pocket money, so I had to, you know, I had to pick certain films. So I didn't actually get round to seeing that till some years later, when I picked up the Dragon, the German Dragon DVD, which is how I imagine a lot of people have probably seen it before.
Yeah, that's how I saw it.
Yeah, and it just really worked for me still, you know, even though I didn't see it at maybe a more formative time. You know, the kills are sufficiently nasty. I love the kind of the synthy kind of score. The location is interesting. I mean, it's a bit different. That always kind of attracted me to the film as well. And it's just off kilter in the best kind of way. It's got this. You can tell it's a film, and we'll go into this. You can tell it's a film that's kind of got heart in it, which seems strange to say of a slasher film that has a woman having a hook rammed up her
Lulu.
I was going to say lady parts, but it is, and you can kind of see it in the kind of, you know, the quirky, endearing theme song, which we all know and love, and just some of the stylistic choices in the film. I think all the kids are for the most part very likable. I love how you go from this really, you know, really grotesque finale with obviously we're getting into spoilers here, with the killer being dispatched in a gruesome manner, and then we go into these outtakes of kind of everyone goofing around on the set, which is just a very bizarre tonal choice, but one that I think makes it stand out and What can I say? When I first finally got around to seeing it, it just ticked all the slasher boxes for me, and it had this, you know, this other kind of quirky charm going on that really endeared it to me. I really want to know what, you know, because I've read your review, Justin, and as you say, scathing indeed. So I'm interested to hear how that's changed, but I think let's kind of keep suspense up for a minute and find out what Eric thinks about it.
Yeah, well, as we know, Justin has no taste because he doesn't like Toya. So what he thinks shouldn't be used as barometer for anything, really. Is that right, Justin?
Well, shall we? We might as well get it out of the way, hadn't we? The burning question, Ewan, is Susie or Toya?
Oh, God.
It's a no-brainer, surely.
Do I have to take either?
It's very diplomatic.
I'll go with Toya.
Oh.
Aha!
Well.
In your face, Justin.
It was very half-hearted, though, wasn't it? So.
It was. Well, you could tell that in my voice, could you?
Yes. But so it's a Pyrrhic victory, Eric.
Well,
why can't you just accept defeat, Justin?
I think I'm going with that. Have I got this wrong? Wasn't Toya in a Doctor Who episode?
I think she was, yeah.
Was she in... I think she might have been in the Happiness Patrol, which was one of
I'm not a Doctor Who fan. I've never seen an episode of Doctor Who in my life, but I just... Yeah.
The whole reason I ended up getting into horror was, well, for the most part, watching the Sylvester McCoy Doctor Who's on TV, and I think she was in an episode, one of the episodes called Happiness Patrol. I think. I need to check that. But
was an episode of Casualty as well.
Wasn't she King of the Daleks?
Maybe it was that as well.
Well done, Justin. That was brilliant.
Thank you. Well, I just thought, well, I remember I sort of, you've never seen Davros and Toya in the same room, have you? So, but anyway, just.
Well, I've never seen Crazy Cat Lady from The Simpsons or Susie in the same room.
Ah, oh, zing. So anyway, get on with it, Eric.
Okay. Well, after two sort of non-slasher movies that we've covered recently, the ponderous but unsatisfying for me, All the Colors of the Dark, and then the really good, but not slasher at all for me, The Hitcher. It's really, really nice to be back on, terra firma with a bona fide American 80s unpretentious slasher movie. The film has the spirit of Friday the 13th and My Bloody Valentine and The Burning, and it's oozing out of its pores. And it's a huge amount of fun. Now, it's a film that I kind of see where you were coming from with your review, Justin, because I didn't really like the film. Like you and I, my introduction was on the Vibco VHS that came out in the early 90s. Now, at that stage, I was savvy enough to know that it was probably going to be cut, but what I wasn't expecting was that it was just going to be a black mush for most of the film. It was unwatchable, really, because I think this was the same in the States, just that its treatment on VHS was kind of lackluster. It belonged to that sort of group of films like Anthropophagus, Pranks, Humongous, films that were out on VHS and just looked awful. And, when it gets to the dark action scenes late in the movie, it becomes, you can't really make out what's going on. And I'm not just saying this because Ewan is on the show. So I said this when the Blu-ray came out, but it was a huge revelation just to see the Blu-ray presentation of the Mutilator, because it completely changes your perception of the movie. Finally, you can see the effects. Well, for starters, it's uncut as well, so you're getting to see the unrated version, and you're also finally able to see what's going on in those darker scenes. And it really made me appreciate the film a lot more. I think it's great. It's a late era slasher movie in terms of the golden era. It came out in 1984. And what I love about it is, as I said, it's very much slasher by numbers. It's following the formula down to a T. The only thing it omits is the kind of the whodunit element, which was kind of prevalent at the time in things like My Bloody Valentine and The Prowler and that. But otherwise, it's dumb but likable teens in an isolated location, drinking beer, having sex, splitting off and getting killed one by one. I suppose the ace up the sleeve is that it delivers on the gore effects. Now, they can look quite crude, especially when you're watching it in high definition, but they're still really effective, I think. And Mark Shostrom has done a terrific job on a very low budget with some of the effects, I thought. And I think the pacing is well done, because there are some slasher movies from the era, like I'm thinking particularly of The Prowler, which top loads all of its best moments into the first 30 minutes, and then you're kind of left with a meandering sort of 45-minute period where, you know, it's people just wandering around. This has the formula down to a T, where once it gets going, people are killed every 5 minutes in spectacularly gruesome ways. And I also have a special place in my heart, and I was hoping that you might have been able to track them down, Ewan, but the two shopkeepers in the start of the movie, I know Nathan shares my joy for their, especially the line, another one of those dumbass college kids taught themselves to buy 2 6-packs instead of one. And just sort of stands there.
If you see the disc, we've got some fun, there's some screen tests which both the shopkeepers are in, actually.
Oh, cool.
There's about 10-12 minutes. I did have more, but I just kind of cut it down to the highlights. But there are some screen tests with those two shopkeepers, and it's just them kind of having a joke around and stuff. It's really funny. I mean, all the screen tests are really funny, actually. But yeah, so there's more on there of them if you want to check it out. But
yes, that was the one extra I didn't get a chance to watch this week. I watched all the other ones.
Well, now you know.
Yep. I'll watch that afterwards. I love the foreshadowing scenes as well, where they go into minute detail about what everything is in the house early in the film. Like, these are pyramid sinkers, which I'd never heard of before, something to do with fishing. Mm-hmm. And if you throw them at a wall, they get wedged in it. Oh, this is where the battle axe is supposed to be, but ooh, it's missing. Where could it be? And then, oh, look at this motorboat. Do you think it's the one? Of course, there's the famous scene where the killer keeps a photo in his living room of some guy he ran over with his motorboat. It's like, what?
I think of everything, that's got to be the red flag, hasn't it? I
mean, yeah, surely.
If that doesn't kind of put you off staying there, I don't know what does. Just a little bit of trivia. I mean, I will be kind of, throwing in stuff that, you know, you can find on the disc. But that picture is actually of the director. I don't know if any of you guys know that.
Buddy Cooper, the
dead guy in the picture.
Mm. Yeah, but anyway, as I was saying, it's just nice to be covering a 100% bona fide slasher again, because it seems like it's been a while since we've done a sort of early 80s golden era movie, and I think this fits nicely in them. And as I said, Arrow's Blu-ray is the best way to watch it. Don't go seeking out the old VHS. I don't care if you're into the sort of the retro thing of watching things on VHS, because The Mutilator was unwatchable in that format. So, big thumbs up for me, and yeah, I'm interested to hear again, because I've read Justin's review. It was very short as well, Justin, which makes me think it was one of your very early entries onto the website.
Yes,
so
yeah.
We're talking maybe close to 20 years since you've written it. So,
Well, let's keep everyone's suspense a little bit longer.
Okay.
Joseph, what do you think of The Mutilator?
I like The Mutilator. I have a few problems with it. I think tonally, it's all over the place. Like, these characters are so likable, and it's so lighthearted when they're kind of goofing around in the house. And then it breaks into these really just kind of almost mean-spirited murder scenes. I mean, I love the gore effects, don't get me wrong. But, I mean, the part, obviously this is a spoiler, but the point where he drags the girl to the garage and sticks the wailing hook up her hoo-ha, it's just so mean-spirited. It's like, okay, I mean, I don't have a weak stomach or a weak constitution for this kind of thing, but it's like it's almost going too far in contrast with how, you know, bubbly and lighthearted the rest of it is when the characters are just kind of, you know, lingering around. So it kind of threw me off a little bit. But having said that, I still like the movie. I think it's a lot of fun. There's not really any kind of, you know, lulls, as it were. I mean, it's always kind of breezy and just kind of, I guess you'd call it fun. I mean, I wish if it's not going to be a whodunit, I almost wish the killer would have wore that mask they find. I thought that would have been that would have added a little to its kind of goofy charm, because the guy looked sort of like a low rent Lawrence Dane, and so I couldn't really take him seriously as a murderer.
That mask was looks ceramic, though. It would be terribly impractical to wear.
Yeah, but anyway. But I like the movie. I think the tone is a little kind of sketchy here and there, but overall it's a lot of fun. I love the fact that this guy, he's obviously crazy, and he's got a pretty good motive. I mean, accidental matricide is a pretty good motive, but at the same time, he seemed unbalanced to begin with. When he comes home, he just doesn't even really say anything when his wife's dead on the floor. It's just the way he just reacts to it. It's like you can tell he's already kind of unbalanced. So it's just one of those, oh, he's already crazy anyway. But I kind of wish they would have put a little more emphasis on the whole accidentally shooting your mother thing. And I think Ed is so well adjusted, it's kind of scary. For a guy who accidentally killed his mom and knows that his father's a little loopy, he's just so well adjusted, it's kind of hard to take him seriously as a kind of a victim of all this. But it's just a few little minor gripes aside, I really do like the Mutilator. I love the theme song. I mean, once I hear it, it gets stuck in my head, and I can't, you know, I have to go listen to music just to get it out of my head. That's how much I love it. But I'd give it a thumbs up. So yeah, thumbs up from me.
Myself and Joseph were just saying before we started the recording that it was a missed opportunity, because I just realized there's an instrumental version of the Fall Break theme song on the Blu-ray and DVD, and it would have been a perfect opportunity for Twisted Hysteria to come out of retirement.
There's still time.
Still time.
In fact, I was doing my vocal training just before I came on in anticipation that we were going to be doing that. But
you've changed, Eric.
What?
You've changed, Eric. It used to be about the music.
Yeah, well, my head's been turned by the industry.
Well, who knows? That may end up on the end of the show. But Nathan, how about you? I imagine this is a film you're quite partial to.
Yeah, I mean, it's a 10 out of 10.
Well, of course.
Obviously.
Yeah, it's just obvious that it's that good. I mean, I love gory murders. I love likable characters. I did kind of feel bad for the characters, because Ed's, Big Ed, you know, Ed Sr. there, he's full of rage. So he really wants them to suffer. So he picks like the most painful ways to take them out. He's not, you know, taking them out in, you know, easy ways, you know, like very quick deaths. No, he's like, you know, I'm going to turn this damn boat mower on and we'll hack you up and, you know, just watch your face while you're dying. So, yeah, he's a little crazy killer. I thought it was kind of crazy that he comes home at the beginning and sees his wife dead on the floor and just immediately thinks his son did it and starts, you know, smacking him and stuff. I'm like, it could have been an intruder.
Exactly.
And if I was the son, I would have said, oh, some guy came in here and did that.
Yeah, it wasn't me.
He totally did. Yeah, it wasn't me. But, you know, I mean, Ed was just a little kid at the time, so I guess I shouldn't blame him too much on that. Plus, it was an accident. But
and his parents should not keep loaded shotguns in the living room.
Oh, yeah. Well, they were in a gun case, right? Because wasn't Ed, like, cleaning them for him?
Yeah.
But that cake looked so good before she got shot. Oh, God, I want a slice of that cake. So the mom actually was a great cake decorator, just as an aside. I thought the cake was, like, looked like it was, like, decorated by, like, a bakery, so... I mean,
this is
scintillating. Nathan's desperate to talk about Great British Bake Off again, isn't he? That's something.
Oh yeah, you got Great British Bake Off. Yeah.
But I really felt awful for the Connie Rogers character, I believe, the one with the hook. Oh my goodness, that's such a horrible way to go out. It's terrible. And it's funny because the death scenes are actually played, you know, very seriously. But, I mean, at the end, how could you take it too seriously when, and spoiler alert, the killer is basically cut in half and then gets up just enough to, like, chop off a leg at the end on the cop that was standing there. It was like, you know, he's...
That happened in real life.
His adrenaline kept him alive.
I've seen that happen in real life, Nathan. It's not...
Oh, you've seen it. So you've actually seen it in person.
A cousin of mine saw that happen, yeah.
Oh, okay. Now it's becoming like a friend of a friend of a friend saw it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I thought it was interesting, too, that I felt like the movie was going to be this when I first watched it years ago. I felt like it was going to build up to this really big showdown between father and son. But for the most part, it's his girlfriend that does all the fighting. You know, she, like, is the one that, you know, burns him with the cigarette lighter and hits him in the head with that thing. Eric mentioned what it was. I've already forgotten what that
pyramid
thing is called.
Pyramid sinkers.
Pyramid sinker, yeah. And she stabs him. I mean, so I like the I've always been partial to final girls, especially if they survive.
That's not what I heard.
And I like to see, for one, I like to see survivors, but I like to see the ones that really fight back in the movies too, which 80s slashers did that a lot. It's probably another reason I love them so much. So I liked her character, and I thought she did a really good job at the end, you know, taking up the final girl duties, as it were. And of course, Fall Break is just an amazing song. I mean, that song's a 10 out of 10, just like the movie is. So, you know, there you have it. Fantastic film. It's not about the cake, but I had to bring it up. So there you go.
And Nathan, can I ask, and Joseph, what was its VHS presentation like in the U.S.?
I seem to recall it being very muddy and dark. So when I first watched this, I think it was in the early 90s, I rented it on one of those 5 for $5 deals that I always talk about on commentaries and stuff. I did not like it because I couldn't see anything. But I have the Blu-ray that Arrow put out, and it is a revelation to watch that, and it's full color and it cleaned up and it just looks really great.
I agree with Joseph. I guess you two just sound so much alike. I got you mixed up.
and indeed we do.
Yes.
But yeah, the original Mutilator on Vestron video was really dark. But the only thing I disagree with Joseph about is even with it that dark, I still, you know, love the movie. It's always been a 10 out of 10 for me.
Right. Well, thank you, Nathan.
Well, everything is a 10 out of 10 for you.
Mm. Not except Silent Rage.
Yeah, I was about to say, except that Chuck Norris one that I couldn't remember.
Yeah, he gave that a 9 out of 10. Yeah. A 9 out of 10 is when he doesn't like it, so.
Well, when I read my review, I realised quite how scathing I was, and I think you're right, Eric. It's probably one of the early reviews, which going back to 1998, so literally a couple of years after Scream came out. But hands on heart, I'm not a huge fan of the Mutilator. I like it a lot better than I used to. And I think back when I was reviewing those films, I was measuring everything up against kind of the classics of, you know, the Friday 13th Part 2s and My Bloody Valentine and House on Sorority Row, the films like that, which had a... I appreciate the Mutilator a lot more now because of what it's trying to do rather than measuring it against kind of those classics. I mean, Buddy Cooper's obviously a lovely man, and I know he's got some talent as a filmmaker, but it hasn't got the suspense for me. There's some suspenseful scenes in it, but it works better as a kind of a cheesy slasher movie. With nothing wrong with that at all. And I think as the years go on, then its charm grows. So I appreciate it for what it is, rather than it's. I don't find it as particularly exciting slasher movie, and I think some of the, you know, the criticisms already made, or kind of the observations about the fact is that it may have worked better if it had been a whodunit, rather than you knowing who the killer is all the way through. But having said that, some of the idiosyncrasies are kind of I really like. It's like to say the fact is the father immediately blaming the son, and also feeding his dead wife whiskey, which I thought was a nice touch. I would, yeah.
Something you can relate to.
I also couldn't, I couldn't take my eyes off Pam's windbreaker. You know, that marshmallow pink thing she had on? Looked like she was wearing a giant marshmallow in the car. Did you not?
Oh, yeah.
You must have seen that. It was kind of like this bizarre pink thing she was wearing that kind of, it screamed, it was screaming 1983 at me. But that I sort of liked. I also like, you know, I liked the fact is that the characters are really kind of fun and likable. I mean, even given the fact is that the acting throughout's a little bit ropey, but that's not necessarily a problem. I also would love to get to like an outtake, like a compilation of shopkeepers in slasher movies, because you've got they've got the ones in this, you've got the ones in I was trying to think what other ones there's. What's it called? Satan's Blade. I mean, there's loads of.
Don't forget Nail Gun Massacre. That's exactly. The ultimate.
Yeah. So one of the great joys. I mean, the gore effects I think are great. Because we'd spoken about this before, is that when you get the Blu-ray kind of presentation, it's such a great presentation from Arrow, that sometimes you can see the joins, like, for instance, when the flashback of the little kid having his throat cut, you can see where the latex starts and ends. Having said that, I mean, given that Mark Sjostrom was, you know, working on a budget and it's the first slasher movie he did, and going that extra mile into, you know, real gross-out territory with the fish hook scene, it certainly has, you know, it certainly stands out from other slasher movies of the time. The ending is great, Grand Guggenheim sort of, you know, horror.
Guggenheim Museum, was it that you were saying?
The Guggenheim Museum, yes. The only thing I thought it kind of missed, actually, was the last scene with the Pam and the main Ed in the hospital. It kind of just kind of ends on a quite anticlimactic scene, doesn't it? Given how kind of silly the movie is, or kind of deliriously fun kind of silliness, I thought that maybe the mutilator would have kind of shuffled down the corridor on his stumps or something like that with a battle axe at the end, but that was not to be. Although maybe you might know whether or not there was ever meant to be. I know there was obviously meant to be a mutilator too, wasn't there? But
Buddy's original idea for a sequel actually revolved around that sacrificial mask that you mentioned before. Mm. I mean, he touches on it in the doc we did. The idea, the loose outline was of an ancient Mayan warrior being kind of reincarnated satisfying his bloodlust amongst another group of teens, I believe, is the rough kind of outline. Mm. But he's actually still talking about, you know, throwing around a few other ideas for a follow-up. So if anyone has any ideas, I'm sure he's all ears.
As long as Pam survives in the sequel, then I think
but you can't awesome. Kill Pam. You can't kill Pam off.
No,
she'll be in a cameo to start and get killed.
She's too chaste. She's just too damn chaste.
She probably still hasn't done it 30 years later.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with the mutilator. I mean, there's the old have sex and die kind of rule, but it feels like it's really driven home in the mutilator. It's like kind of constant with the scenes between Ed and Pam, and, you know, he's her making him sleep with his clothes on and things like that.
Mm.
Seems particularly chaste.
It is kind of curious. I mean, I think sort of, but there's in the documentary, I mean, essentially sort of Buddy was kind of, you know, like many filmmakers before him, was making a horror movie was a good way to make money, wasn't it? And to cut your teeth as a film director. So,
He would tell you he didn't make any money from the film.
No, I know. Yes, I know. But that's the intention. Yes. Yeah. Because I know sort of like the people behind, say, Graduation Day, Herb, it's not Herb Friedman, it's Herb something, I can't remember his last name, but Herb Fried, that's it, yeah. Him and his wife, when they kind of were kind of watched slasher movies and used a stopwatch to look, see how measure the time between murders, so they were making quite almost a kind of, not exactly a clinical slasher movie, but they kind of looked to see what was popular, and I kind of guess we've had lots of conversations about this in the past, about whether or not the tropes of the slasher movie were apparent at the time, or they became apparent more later on. But the whole have sex and die thing, and I know John Carpenter's Deborah Hill was sort of always denied that they kind of invented that, or it was ever intentional. But I imagine a lot of filmmakers watching these films would have seen that this kind of formula, the mutilator is very formulaic, and that's not a bad thing, obviously, because we're talking about slasher movies, and actually formulaic when it comes to slasher movies sometimes is better than being too kind of out there and going off in different directions. So, it's kind of interesting to sort of have that kind of virginal character who again turns out to be the final girl ultimately, kind of linking on from some, you know, following on from your Laurie Strodes of the world. So, I mean, I kind of guess that we're kind of getting into background and stuff. I mean, I just kind of I wanted to ask you, Ewan, sort of, you know, when you went over to the States, because one of the things that came out of the documentary was that this was kind of still kind of very much celebrated locally as a kind of a film. There seemed to be a lot of excitement. I mean, presumably a lot of the people, when you interviewed them, were they all still kind of local to that area?
Well, so when we kind of started putting together you know, the extras for the Mutilates, and I was planning on going over. Buddy, essentially, I mean, as I think it's stated in the doc, he, you know, his, to fill everyone else in, you know, when he made the film, his father owned and ran the motel, the Oceanana Motel in Atlantic Beach. And so when he came to make this film, they were able to film, you know, the whole film there on the beach out the front and put all the cast and crew up at the motel. Mm. And Buddy now owns and runs the motel. So when I was planning to go there, he kind of arranged for, you know, the people that he was in touch with to kind of all, you know, come down to the motel so we could film them all in the same place. I think for the most part, I'm trying to think, Matt Mittler, who plays Ed, is in New York, so he had to come from New York. Pam, Ruth Martinez, is her married name. She's in North Carolina. She's in Greensboro, I think, which is maybe 3 hours. I think it's like a 3-hour drive, something like that. Mm. Who else? Ed, who was assistant editor and also assisted with makeup. He features quite heavily in our doc. He actually, I think he spends his time between Atlantic Beach and New York, and he actually works at the motel as well. So he was obviously there. Mm. Who else have we got? Obviously, we interview like Buddy's wife, who plays, you know, the mum in the opening sequence, and his son, who plays the kid in the opening sequence. They're all still local.
Can I ask, did you try and track down Maury Lampley? Because he
I pretty much took Buddy's lead on who he could kind of bring together. I mean, while you want to kind of get absolutely everyone you can, and we've got, you know, a hell of a lot of people for the doc, it's sometimes it just doesn't kind of quite come together, as I'm sure you guys find trying to locate people, you know, when you interview them for the podcast.
No, I was just curious because Justin was touching on sort of the acting in some scenes being a bit iffy, and he would be the one who would stand out as being the
chief
iffiest
offender.
You know, I don't want to be mean, but yeah, he would be. And I was just curious to know if he was approached and if he declined because he's a bit more...
I can't remember if Buddy was... I don't think Buddy was in touch with him at all. I kind of took his lead. You know, he sort of got as many people involved as he could. So I don't think he tried to get in touch with him, from what I remember. I'm just trying to think. Francis, who plays, let me see, the first girl to get drowned. We did have some tentative discussions with her, but that didn't work out for various reasons. So that's the only person I'm aware of that we tried to get, and it didn't work out.
I was just curious about the because one of the guy who plays the cop, Ben Moore, was in 2000 Maniacs, which was, so what was kind of Herschel Gordon Lewis, was that kind of a direct inspiration for Buddy? I just wondered if that, because obviously the gore, you know, the gore effects and the kind of blood, almost like blood, you know, a blood feast, kind of that, the whole beach kind of murder stuff, and whether or not he cast Ben Moore in it because it was a nod to Gordon Lewis, or was that just accidental?
I don't think it was as much a nod, but I think Ben Moore was quite local.
Right.
I can't remember exactly how I know him, but it was actually Ben Moore, actually, I think he kept, you know, turning up at their offices kind of lobbying for a part, as far as I remember. Okay. So I don't think there was like a Herschel Gordon. I mean, certainly in the case of casting Ben, but I don't think Buddy himself was particularly inspired by H.G. Lewis. But
So it's just kind of a happy accident. But it just seems kind of, if you're going to get someone.
I think he wanted Ben Moore on board because of his, you know, his splatter credentials. Obviously, Ben Moore's in a few of H.G. Lewis's films. He's in Moonshine Mountain as well, which was shot around the same time as 2000 Maniacs. It's less of a horror, but it does have some kind of bits of gruesomeness along the way, which unfortunately have kind of been cut along the way. But, yeah.
Does anyone else want to chime in with some background? I know, obviously, you've got a lot. Do you want to?
I'll throw him, actually, it's not really background as such, but it's kind of coming back to, I think Joseph was talking about the intro, the introduction to the film, and how the how Big Ed already seems kind of disturbed from the start. Mm. I always found that really strange. I always thought tonally that was a really weird intro, which obviously I've grown to very much appreciate. But I always found it really odd how he's obviously not quite right from the get go. He comes back and his reaction to finding his dead wife is to prop her up and try and feed her some whiskey. And I also, it also is just odd how he doesn't really kind of say anything as well, in that opening scene. If it was a normal person coming back and finding their dead spouse, you think they would be a bit more vocal about it. Mm. And I was watching, the German DVD, which has the English language track, but just accidentally, when I was watching that scene, I accidentally flipped over to the German track. And I thought this was quite interesting that they actually dub over when he sort of runs and finds his wife on the floor and goes to, see that she's dead. They sort of dub over with him saying, mein Gott, which I thought that was subtly kind of interesting, because whoever was dubbing it obviously thought he needs to have some kind of a vocal emotional response to this. I just thought that was quite interesting.
But it's interesting. I mean, presumably throughout the film, obviously we can't put too much, thought into it, but that he must have repaired his relationship with his son enough to, because Ed keeps on talking about his father as if he's kind of not, he's an eccentric, but he sort of says, oh, he won this, he did that. So he's obviously had a relationship with him all this time, but it doesn't actually ever say why he suddenly now decides to kill Ed and his friends, sort of presumably it's what, 15 years later or something.
Yeah. Maybe that could be the subject of a kind of a prequel, perhaps.
Yeah, very possibly. Yes.
Mutilated origins or something. Maybe he's been at it all the time in the interim. It's just he hasn't taken it out on Ed as yet. Who knows? There isn't really an obvious reason for him.
I had a theory.
Okay,
go on.
My theory is that he tried to suppress it for all those years, and it just came out in kind of mild mental and maybe physical abuse on Ed, because Ed obviously doesn't care for his father at all, but obviously he doesn't think he's a murderer. But I think he's ran over this guy with the boat, and it's kind of awakened this bloodlust in him. And then he's like, well, I'm going to take it out on, who I really blame for a lot of stuff. I'm sure he blamed Ed for a lot of things that happened after the original accident. So I took it to be that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. You could infer, because Ed says at some point how his dad boasts that he's hunted everything except man or something like that. So maybe we can infer he's been taking his bloodlust out on poor animals in the interim, and now he's progressing to a bigger game. I don't know.
Although that poor man he ran over with his outboard motor.
Well, yeah, probably. Of course. Yeah. That's not the most positive sign either, is it?
No, it really isn't. I do like the scene where they're playing hide and seek in the house, but it's everything. Is it? I presume it's meant to be kind of dark.
Well, that's interesting, because that was actually a scene, because we had limited options when we were restoring and grading this film, because we got access to a print. I'd say release print, but it was from the Library of Congress, so I think it had probably only been played about once. So it was great condition, and you can kind of see that in the in the transfer. But because we were going from a print as opposed to like a preprint material, like a negative or an interpositive, we had limited options as to what we could do with the darkening of the scenes. So I kind of looked back at the old the old VHS, the old DVD, and that scene is quite a bit darker, and we did a test of trying to make that a little bit darker, because I did sort of flag when we were looking over it that it did seem a little on the light side, and perhaps a tad you know, unconvincing that they aren't able to see each other when they're standing right next to each other. And we did have a little test at kind of darkening it, but that ended up kind of, like I said, you have limited room to play with. And when we started to darken it, that started to kind of crush the blacks, which means, you know, you lose the detail in the blacks. And we ran it by the Direx and we decided to go with it as is. Now, if we were to have, you know, I mean, that's, for the most part, it's, you know, it was a good element we're working with. But that's an instance where, you know, particularly in a film like this, you know, where you really, you know, having access to that negative or that earlier material earlier in the printing chain could make a difference. So ideally, yeah, I mean, the director was happy with it as we presented it. So for us, that's sufficient. And like I said, we couldn't have made it really any darker without going the other way and losing detail. So so if there's anything that, you know, I would kind of want to go back and review, it would be that, I guess.
Okay, cool. Well, yeah. It's interesting. It's just kind of, yeah, it's fascinating to hear what the choices were behind the scenes on that. So, I mean, the other thing I did wonder, Ewan, you might better shed some light on, was the film. I think it says on the IMDb that it got a cinema release in the States in the beginning of 1985. But it was. I was looking at the copyright details, and it seemed to be like it copyright sort of went back to 1983. So, do you know? Mm-hmm. Was it kind of filmed in like the fall of 83? Does that sound about right?
I think it was filmed in the month of May 83.
Yeah, May okay. and June 83. Because if you look at the behind the scenes footage on the Blu-ray, you can see the clapperboards saying May and June. Yeah. Mm.
There you go. Someone's done their research.
Yes. Yeah. There we go.
More than me. And then, yeah, I think, like you said, it came out in 85, did you say?
Yeah, well, it kind of ran into quite a lot of because it has kind of an interesting release kind of history, doesn't it? Because it kind of, am I right in thinking it got released unrated, didn't it? In the cities like New York and places, and then they wouldn't take it in the provinces basically unrated. So
that sounds rude.
It does. I'm talking of euphemisms, I bet you've taken it in the provinces a few times, Eric.
Ooh, yeah.
But
we'll see.
But is that's right, isn't it? It then got cut for an R rating, which kind of I think that's one of the things I sort of said actually in my review, or I think if I'm remembering correctly. And one of the problems is when you have gore movies that have been cut for video or whatever, and we've spoken in the past about Burial Ground when that got released as Knights of Terror on VHS with pretty much every single bit of violence cut out, is you're essentially left with what is not a porn film without the pop shots, but it's essentially that is you've got the whole it's whole reason for being is missing, and sometimes the interconnecting material isn't strong enough to really to hold it together. So
yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that the kind of star of the show with the mutilator, as you know, Buddy himself would say, is the gore effects. You know, everything is kind of structured around those. You know, so it's not unfair to say that, you know, with that stuff neutered, it does kind of decrease its impact quite significantly, but as a whole, as I say, you know, I just love the quirky weirdness of the film, and you know, the gore is a standout, but it's the glue that binds it all together, I guess I would say.
I mean, I love on the documentary he was talking about, he sort of, you know, I'd never actually thought of the when he said about the title Fall Break, and Buddy was saying it was kind of actually quite a clever title when you think about it, because it's fall as in autumn, but falling down and breaking. So, but it wasn't quite as exploitative enough, was it? So obviously the Mutilator title was given to it, and then the ad agency, I think, came up with that artwork for the, which is the artwork I kind of know better than the Fall Break artwork, which is the people hanging up on the hooks, and of course probably the best tagline of all time, isn't it? It's probably, you know, by sword, by pick, by axe, bye, you know, it doesn't really get much better than that, does it? So
or if we go by the, which I, again, a difference with the Vipco sleeve is they tweaked it to by pick, by axe, by chainsaw, bye, as opposed to was it by pick, by sword, by axe?
Yes.
So they felt the need to sex it up with a chainsaw there. I thought that was interesting.
I am. I'm just looking at that VHS artwork you were mentioning, Ewan, and I do. Yeah, it looks like the killer from The Burning holding an axe aloft, and he's got he's wearing a pair of overalls that have a print of the cover of the Boogeyman on it.
And weirdly enough, also if you're looking at that, friend, you know, any listeners will need to pull it up on their screen. What always fascinated me about that cover as well is there's this big splodge on the top left-hand corner below the Vipco logo that looks like someone has just Tippexed something out.
Yes.
I found that fascinating as well.
Mm. Yeah, well, they were kind of a sort of DIY label by all accounts, I think, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, yes. Well, that's why we love them.
Yeah, I kind of guess partly the reason that the film didn't get it, because it would have been probably one of the biggest video nasties, wouldn't it, if it had come out in time. But I'm just presuming it just wasn't released in time in this country, was it?
Yeah. I mean, I was wondering that the other, you know, something I wonder. I mean, it would definitely been top of the chopping list, I would have thought, if it had hit that kind of prime period for video nasties, but it just about missed it.
Yeah.
Apparently, that the Vipco release from the early 90s, the only scene that was cut was the fish hook scene. Everything else was intact.
I believe that's correct. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I was just going to say, I don't know if Eric will know this, but what is the link between the mutilator and Susie and the Banshees?
Oh, God. She mutilates all her songs?
Oh, I knew you'd come back with that. Yeah, so predictable. Does anyone else know?
Alan Dale?
No.
Girl with big hair turns into a cockroach.
No, it was actually. I remember reading an interview of Mark Shostrom in Gore Zone, the old American sort of spin-off from Fangoria, and I think it's about this movie, or he's talking about the Mutilator, and he's listening to Susan the Banshees while he's working on his special effects.
Now I'm disappointed.
Fairly tenuous.
Because I really thought that you were going to say tenuous. Something else.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was just a bit of fun fact, isn't it? A little bit tenuous. So I'm surrounded by cats at the moment. I've got two on me, and one of them's just chuffed. So anyway, the glamour of the hysteria continues.
Lovely. Thank you, TMI.
Well, actually, if you want to hear too much information, we were away last night, and we came back, and Seabiscuit had... I could smell a turd, but I couldn't find it. And then she'd laid a Havana cigar-sized turd on one of the chairs in the kitchen.
Lovely.
Was that any kind of a protest against anything? Was that just...
Yeah, she does have a protest. It's basically if we go away and leave them overnight, she does protest poos.
Yeah.
So
much
like Eric.
Protest poos. That's a new one.
Well, I mean, we've all done that, haven't we, guys?
Yeah, I think so. I do that all the time.
I can imagine. Yeah. I imagine Eric's terror for it. So anyway, back to
listening to Toy as a protest poo.
Hey.
Yeah, that's true. So, from the poopulator to the mutilator, back we go again. So, Nathan, do you have any background for us?
Well, I did have that Ben Moore was in 2000 Maniacs, you ruined that one for me.
Oh.
Well done, Justin.
Oh. I know.
Hope you're happy.
Actually, I will say, though, that in the 2000 Maniacs, are you going to play the rhubarb lady?
Because my lawnmower is stolen bitch by a fucking pig.
That's me on a daily basis, actually. But in 2000 Maniacs, Ben Moore hacked up a character with an axe, and in the Mutilator, he gets hacked up with an axe. It's like full circle.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Circle of life.
Yeah. Mm. Hang on, let me pull up IMDb right quick. I'm just kidding. I just said that because that's what Justin accuses me of doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the cat fits.
I did read an interview with Matt Mittler, and I mean, my favorite trivia is actually more about the hijinks of the cast and crew more than anything else. So the cast got along, you know, very, very well. He mentioned that Ruth Martinez was a little more prim and proper, but they won her over. So I'm like, I bet that was a fun time on set.
They corrupted her, in other words.
Well, it sounded like making slasher movies in the early 80s was a bit of a blast, wasn't it? It was a bit like in Just Before Dawn, they were sort of saying they were out partying all night. And, I imagine there'd probably some stories to be told from the from the motel with the mutilator.
It just stinks because, I mean, I couldn't get to see these movies on their initial run because I was only four when this came out. I'd like to be able to see a lot of these in the theater.
I think that was particularly the case, like, with this film, and I think that's why we ended up kind of making a kind of a feature-length doc as opposed to just, a kind of a short thing. It was just as we kind of were talking to people, the kind of story behind it really kind of started to show itself, and the fact that they were all there living in the motel and it was all this big kind of family atmosphere. I mean, I think that's the case for a lot of kind of low-budget films, but it really felt particularly the case here. And that they were all there by at the beach, the motel, having, kids having a laugh. But I'm just one of the things I found particularly surprising when I went to the motel is the pool, because when I got there, you can look up the motel online. It's theoceanana.com, I think, and their pool is the actual pool where the skinny dipping. It probably prevents herpes. oh, you get in. That's where that all happens. That's the pool that, the motel's pool that's in service, even though in the film it's, again, the magic of movies, it's supposed to be away down the beach. And when I first saw it and Buddy said, yeah, that's the pool, I was just really, really confused. I thought there's no way that's the pool because it looks so much smaller in real life, and also you don't quite. I mean, obviously it's quite extensively dressed in the film. You know, you've got all that potted plants, and it's covered with that big awning. It's quite triangular in reality, and you don't quite get that in the film. And it was so bizarre because it just looks so much smaller than you think it would. So it took me a while to get my head around that. I think one of my favourite anecdotes from the shoot was the fact that they needed to get the right kind of opacity of the water to make the hide and seek in the pool kind of quote unquote convincing. Because I don't know about anyone else. I don't know if you've tried to play hide and seek in a pool, but it doesn't really last very long. Mm. But in order to get that kind of to make it murky enough, they actually poured milk into the pool, which I think was just, I think that's one of my favourite anecdotes. And we spoke to a guy who was kind of working at the motel at the time, and he was one of the guys who was pouring pints of milk into the pool to try and get it the right kind of murkiness.
Well, that's kind of, I'd imagine anyone staying there, if it wasn't part of the cast and crew, must have been a bit disappointed if they came down for a nightly dip.
He was saying Ed, who works there now, was saying it would take days for that to kind of circulate and come out the system now. So, he was saying it was they got quite a kick out of going and telling the guests that they were off to put milk in the pool and kill someone in there.
I mean, just out of interest, does Buddy still works at the hotel? I mean, at the motel, is there kind of mutilator memorabilia up there? Do people come and stay there because they know
not as much as there should be? Mm. He could make quite a racket out of kind of mutilator themed holidays. I think that needs to be his next sideline. I mean, Buddy himself has loads of memorabilia. I mean, it was, the first day I got there, he'd kind of called a production meeting, and I went into his office, and there was Matt Mittler and John Douglas, the assistant director. Ed was there, Buddy was there, and he had, the big kind of standees for the mutilator and the original hook he was waving about. It was all very surreal. He's got tons of stuff. He's actually been selling a lot of it on to fans via Facebook. If you look for him on Facebook, he's been selling off a lot of. I think he had originally he had like hundreds of the 7-inch vinyl of the soundtrack of the theme. Mm. Like tons of posters. Film stills and just all kinds of stuff. But yeah, I would, his office is kind of, is the kind of the museum to the mutilator, I guess, although an unofficial one.
Okay.
And well, there's a story he tells on one of the commentary tracks that it looked like he came sort of perilously close to getting a deal with New Line Cinema for distribution.
Yeah. And who knows, you know, what that would have done for the film. I think he was saying that's when Nightmare on Elm Street kind of came along. And
yeah, they were looking for a horror property of humans, sort of saying. And it looked like Buddy was the one who said no rather than them. Would that be true?
I don't remember what the story was.
He was saying that the film cost $450,000 to make, and that he was close to signing a deal with New Line, but they wanted something to do with the promotion of the film. He didn't agree with, so he decided to promote it himself. So he spent another $200,000 on prints and publicity. And he said that in the meantime, New Line went off and picked up Nightmare on Elm Street instead. And
So we might have seen a whole franchise if that had happened.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm. Yeah.
Son of Mutilator.
Yes. Mutilator versus Jason.
Yeah.
Still happen. You could do a kind of a meta film, couldn't you? With if someone turns up at the motel and starts murdering the guests, and sort of Buddy's trying to find out who the killer is. That would be like Buddy Cooper's new nightmare, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Well. I mean, as I said, Buddy's still very much motivated to make a kind of follow-up, and we are kind of throwing around some ideas, so that might not be entirely off the mark.
Okay, cool.
I'll just leave a dot, dot, dot there.
Okay. That sounds good.
There were two scenes that were altered during production. One was the death of, is it Linda? Is her name, the girl in the pool who gets drowned? Originally, that was supposed to be a more graphic spear gun death.
Mm.
But at the last minute, the effect didn't work, so they just decided to do that slow motion shot of her being grabbed from underneath the water and drowned. Mm. The other one was the original ending was supposed to, Big Ed was supposed to be chopped in two by a drawbridge, but apparently it was either there was a combination of being too impractical to do the effect, and also the local authorities were denying them permission to do it anyway. So that's why they went with him being chopped in half by the car.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think Buddy said, they went, like you said, weren't able to get permission. It was a type of, drawbridge, but it's kind of a turning bridge, I think. So he was supposed to get kind of crushed as it kind of turned.
I also, in the documentary, I saw that there's an interesting still image where I just spotted that it played on a double bill with Pieces in New York, which that would have been a nice afternoon out of the cinema.
Yeah, wow.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I'd also love that the killer. I think when they went to the story of they went to see the Mutilator, didn't they? In the New York and sort of one of the grindhouses, and everyone was there sitting next to a couple of girls who were just looking, but being very nonchalant and just not really reacting. But am I right thinking the killer? He sort of turns. Someone says, "Oh, look, it's a Mutilator," and they turn around and see him and scream.
Yeah.
That was
Jack Chatham, I think, was saying Big Ed himself.
Yes, yeah. So that was.
I unfortunately didn't get to meet Jack Chatham. That was that particular interview was filmed by. He was supposed to be there when I went, but he couldn't for various reasons. So that was actually shot by Buddy afterwards. I would have liked to have met him, but he seems very. It's difficult to kind of place him as the guy who. Does such unspeakable things with a hook, you know, he seems such a nice, avuncular kind of guy.
Well, that's quite often, isn't it? You see that with many of the kind of the slasher movie villains, people say what a lovely person they were in real life. That's acting for you, isn't it? I guess so. But cool. Is there anything else before we get, because I know we've got some people have written in some of their, so should we actually maybe go on to that? We can come back with a little bit more feedback, a little bit more background if we dredge anything else out with Fishhook. But Joseph, did you want to sort of read out what people on the Facebook group have said about Mutilator?
Sure. I just hear some noise. I can't really hear anything. Anyway.
So, sounds like someone's taking down a pair of folded
pair of knickers.
Or a pair of knickers, yeah. Is that you, Eric? Is that what's making so much noise?
Mine stay on.
Can
I just notice that when I was watching the, the end credits were rolling, and I just spotted that one of the people who played student at dorm was Phil Collins.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he must have been, like, at a loose end that day. Taking a break from recording his latest drab, overproduced 80s album.
Yes, well.
Mutilo.
Very good. Justin wouldn't understand that because he didn't like pop music. He only likes his goth stuff.
Mm, that's not true, Eric, and you know it. But anyway, Joseph, are you good to go?
Yeah, let's see. Kevin Lewis says, just in time for a fall break. Overall, I really love this movie. It's classic mid-80s fun. It is a little tongue-in-cheek and has great gore, if you're watching the right version. The characters are likable, albeit the final girl was a bit weak. I know Nathan would disagree with that.
I did, vocally on the board, too.
Yeah. The theme song feels like a mixture of Footloose and a late 80s sitcom hook. The rest of the score is synth done right. I'd give it a 7 out of 10. Glad you guys finally got to this one. Jenny Hall Cameron says, I'm ready for a fall break. A couple more things to write. Probably one of my favorite horror movie boxes and slogans. My stupid father was cheap, so we had a vacation to Panama City during Thanksgiving. It was cold and breezy on the beach, so it made me think of this movie. Still can't believe the vaginal death. Wow. Let's see. Andrew Rooney says, don't you hate it when you're trying to shine your father's rifle as a lovely surprise and you accidentally shoot your mother? Shining your father's rifle is not a euphemism, Eric. Please, Eric, sing the tune, deep voice. We're going on a falsetto. Fall break. Wahoo, fish hook to the hoo-ha. I love the titles of these no-frills, low-budget 80s horror flicks. Mutilator, Blood Rage, etc. It gets you in the mood. The artwork is spot on and the kills are suitably gory. Surprisingly good special effects, too, for a very low-budget film. I get confused between this and Nailgun Massacre, but I do believe this is the one with the outstanding store scene. The zany kids are on the way to their sexin' and a druggin' weekend, and the movie grinds to a halt for some insanely poor acting. I recall this film being very dark and grainy, which just adds to the 1985 VHS-ness. Mean-spirited and grimy, but I love it. Let's see. Wes Ray says, hey, guys, I'm not sure if you cover this in the episode or not as you're currently taping it, but one thing I've always wondered about the Mutilator. The VHS cover artwork and the original US one-sheet artwork are almost exactly the same. So why didn't they just use the original poster art for the VHS cover? The one-sheet art is a bit more rough around the edges, and the VHS art comes across more polished. So maybe that's the reason. It kind of reminds me of the first DVD release of Final Exam by BCI, where instead of just using the awesome original one-sheet for the DVD cover, they inexplicably posed a hulking figure holding a knife under the moonlight in what I have to assume was a poor attempt to recreate Final Exam's iconic poster art with a real person. Truly bizarre. Oh, and as for the fall break theme song, it always sounded like the kind of cheesy jingle you'd hear in a mid-80s beer commercial.
It does.
Yeah, I would agree with him about the poster. It's weird about the Final Exam one in particular because they do the exact same thing as the poster art, but it's like a photo instead of like artwork. Mm. So it is kind of weird.
Can you shed any light?
Yeah, I think that was a Vestron choice. I think Buddy, you know, favors the original one much more. For whatever reason, I think Vestron decided that it needed to be kind of reworked a bit.
Okay. Mike Paul Sanders says, I hate that damn song. Otherwise, it's great. Nasty flick that has both a mean streak in terms of the kills. Like when one of the girls has a fishing gaff impaled in a very interesting place, as well as a dark sense of humor. Bob Hartshorn says, even though I prefer my slashers to keep the killer's identity shrouded in mystery until the finale, the Mutilator still offers much to enjoy. The slow pace is made up for via likable characters, an atmospheric beach location, and some splendid slayings. My fave has to be the wooden Sam Flash Gordon Jones look act-alike orgasmic demise. If only he'd screamed more, baby, more. Give it to me. Hilarious. Two mutilated thumbs up. David Cook says, unfairly slammed in, I think, the UK Bloody Birthday commentary for some reason. It's a fun popcorn movie with a great final girl. I love how she deals with the annoying Pratt who goes on about her virginity. Sean Gamble says, oh, thank fucking God. With all the hype surrounding this film before a legit release came out, I was forced to buy a bootleg of it and wasn't disappointed in the least. Lovable cast, great set pieces. The film gets a little wonky, but it's fabulous and it deserves to be in everyone's collection. Justin Kosh, who we had on not too long ago, says, so much fun, this one. Some great stuff in the Arrow Blu-ray, too. I might have to give it another watch.
Going back to the audio commentary for Bloody Birthday, that was you, Justin, wasn't it?
I think it must have been, yes.
Don Anelli says, one of the better B-tier slashers from the 80s, great gore, solid stalking, and a ton of cheesy charm and heart. Falls a bit short in terms of story, but not detrimental to the film at all that much. Von Kalmier says, it's a fucked up flick. The killer is deliberately killing cause of an accident. Nasty, nasty movie. I love every minute of it. Neil Lemoy says he loves this. And finally, Louis Adams says, yes, been waiting for you guys to do this one. And that's all I have.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you also for everyone getting in contact with the show, because obviously we love to hear from you. So, and obviously we read out as much as we can. I'll just play you the contact details now, and this is how to get in contact with the show.
The content of this podcast was provided by Justin Kurzweil, Eric Frillfall, Nathan Johnson, and Joseph Henson. If you enjoy our program and are willing and able to provide a donation, please visit us on Patreon and become a content designated subscriber. That's patreon.com/thehysteriacontinues. For non-subscriber PayPal donations and general feedback, our address is the.hysteria.continues@gmail.com. To listen and interact, simply search for The Hysteria Continues on iTunes, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Susie versus Toya forever.
Yeah, so please do write in. As I say before, we'd love to hear from you. Is there anything else you wanted to add, Ewan, about The Mutilator before we kind of wrap things up?
I guess I was just interested to see how other people felt, you know, if there was going to be a Mutilator 2, you know, how they feel that could be continued.
Well, that kind of chimes in with Nathan's kind of regular features.
After the credits.
Yeah. After the credits.
Yes, after the credits.
Oh, sorry, have I been a bit premature here?
No. It's the right
actually,
time.
I think it leads right into it quite nicely. Yeah.
It's almost like you told me to say that.
It's telekinesis.
Yeah. It's usually Eric that's premature, so I've heard. But
well, my joke of the week might also...
we got Eric's joke of the week too, yes, so get that tumbleweed ready.
Yeah, okay. But Nathan, after the credits.
Okay, after the credits. I need my own jingle for that. I'll have to come up with something. But so obviously at the end of this film, we see a very loving moment, which I thought was quite nice. My interpretation of this scene is Ed has put his hand on Pam's shoulder to say, not to worry, I'm not crazy like my father. We can be married and enjoy a life of religious fulfillment. And, you know, they look longingly out the window at the sunset. It's almost like walking into the sunset. So I was thinking that on a happy note, they would just be married and live happily ever after. And a sequel would involve Ed's kids going. But instead of Ed being the one killing his son and their friends, here goes my cat. Instead of Ed being the one killing his son and his friends, it's a whodunit. And Ed actually can come back and be the big hero. That's my idea.
I thought you were going to say that the kid was going to end up being the killer. Like the killing gene kind of skips a generation or something.
Hey, but you killed my grandpa.
Son of music.
And my grandma. Yeah.
I do feel like they kind of missed a trick by not kind of having, you know, right at the end in a kind of a shock moment, having Ed turning to the camera and like have green flashing eyes like Thriller.
Mm. Yeah, or the end of Friday 13th Part 4 with Corey Feldman's kind of wink.
Exactly.
Mm.
I actually was expecting that. I was expecting a moment where Ed just kind of has a weird look where you kind of wonder, okay, is he gone crazy now? But they didn't really go that route. Mm.
I still think it would have been fun to have had them being chased during Halloween 2 at the end with Big Ed chasing them down but dragging himself very slowly, so they just had to walk very slowly away from him. That would have been fun, but
in the hospital,
yeah. The slowest killer ever. But
now there's tumbleweed for you.
Well, yeah. I'll edit that out, Eric.
Eric, what happened?
We have to play my joke of the week jingle then.
Yeah. Okay. Well, hold on. Let me find it. Oh, sorry, it's a bit premature.
Yeah.
It's my joke of the week. It's so fantastic.
Okay, so the sequel to The Mutilator is going to be about a cannibal who likes to devour women while pretending he's a cat. You got all that? He's a cannibal who likes to devour women while pretending he's a cat. He's going to kidnap women and then he'll mew till he ate her. He'll mew till he... Don't go dissing on my joke because my humour is too sophisticated for you to comprehend, Justin. You just didn't get the joke. I'll explain the joke to you after, Justin.
I loved it, Eric. Eric, I thought it was hilarious. The best joke ever.
Thank you, Justin. You and I hope your sides aren't too sore from laughing at that joke.
I'm just recovering now.
Okay. Yeah.
We do offer free therapy sessions after each podcast to our guests.
I was going to ask about that.
It's also funny that Eric couldn't even finish the joke before Justin threw it.
Yeah, I know.
It's almost like you were prepared to hate on that joke.
Yeah, exactly.
Mutilate, wah, wah, wah.
Yeah.
Justin already knew in advance.
I thought you'd finished a joke. Have you finished it?
See, Justin, this is another example of you interrupting.
Mm. Yeah.
I can see
why he's turning to Rhubarb Lady. You bring out the worst in people, Justin.
Oh, dear. Well, again, glimpsing behind the dirty curtain of the hysteria continues. So, yes, was there anything else we wanted to talk about? Joseph, you've got, what about your game?
Well, we're recording out of whack, and we haven't released the last one, so I'm going to hold off until the next episode. So, no game this episode.
Okay, yes, because we'd say we're going to be, as I mentioned at the opening, as it were, of the show, I think we're going to be releasing these throughout the summer, so we are recording a little bit in advance. So if we've kind of missed out reading your comments on films that we're covering, it's not intentional, it's just because we're time-travelling a little bit, But that's been a fun one, and thank you, Ewan, for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you with us, and also somebody who's kind of been to the sets and all that. You know, it's been a real treat. So I hope you listened to the show. So I hope you've enjoyed being part of it.
Well, I have. It was tempting to switch off at points and think that I was still listening to it. So I hope I chimed in at the appropriate points.
Oh, absolutely.
But thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Fantastic. Well, we all switch off when Eric talks anyway, so I don't know.
See how bullied I am on this podcast. I bet you he's going to play out with some stupid Susie song as well.
No, I've kind of, actually, Party's Fall is, it might be appropriate. No, but I think I'm going to play out with...
Don't Fall in Love by Toya. That's the fall in the title as well.
Well, who knows? Might be a mega mix. But, Joseph, what do we have? We've got...
We have the theme song, Fall
of
Break.
Of course, absolutely. So, well, you sounded surprised.
What unusual choice.
Yeah.
Nathan was really?
I was thinking what we were going to play out with, and I was like, oh, well, of course, why would we not play out with Fall Break? It's an amazing song, first of all. It's probably better than anything in Susie and Toya's catalog.
How dare you?
Oh, Nathan.
I actually really like the song, though. I really do. I think it's a fun song.
It is a fun song, so we're going to play out with that, but... Ewan, thank you ever so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And well, hopefully you'll be back on again soon. So here, say goodbye to the good people as we play out with Fall Break.
Bye.
Bye, sword. Bye, pick. Bye, axe. Bye-bye.
Mew till he ate her.
When the leaves of summer turn red and gold and the football games bring a hint of the cold, time to get away.
Oh, Justin.
Oh, Justin. We'll pack the car with escape in mind. Take the black veil off, Justin, and maybe we'll hear your voice clearer. Why can't Justin be more like Nathan?
Empty cottage sitting on the shore. He looks very friendly in that picture.
Yeah, but believe me, he's not. He's evil.
Evil incarnate.
Yeah, we're going to have a good time. We're going on now. A ball break, walking hand in hand in the moonlight.
Is that you, Eric? Oh, I thought you were the one making weird noises.
No, that must have been Joseph. Or you, and I don't know.
How dare you?
I'll break into your heart.